Thank you very much, Gabriel, and I greet the audience. First of all, let me apologize for the absence of any illustrative material and generally of a PowerPoint. I'll try to be eloquent as I can in a language which really towers even that mountain of tongues nowadays. And I understand quite clearly that as Alice, though before her great trip to the Wonderland, used to think that books would know pictures and know conversations, they are really worth nothing. But since there are no pictures, I think at least conversations will abound during the discussion. So, dear colleagues and friends, first of all, let me express once more, but not less sincerely, my gratitude to the organizers of this remarkable event, to the Netherlands Inter-University School of Islamic Studies, to La Casa de Velázquez, and in particular, from my part, to l'Institut d'études sur l'Islam et les sociétés du monde musulman. And I'm especially thankful to Bernard Héberger and Gabriel Martinez-Gross for their kind invitation to participate with a keynote speech, an unexpected favor for me and a pleasant responsibility as well. And evidently to Nathalie Bernard-Maugiron for her solicitude to organize my coming here. There's so many difficulties which aroused quite unexpectedly also. So, working on a range of problems connected with ethnic identities in pre-modern Middle East, as viewed, conceptualized, and articulated in Arabic, Persian, and Turkic narrative sources, with a more profound involvement into the Iranian case, I have been very interested in the verbal vehicles of these identity models. That is to say, in a simpler way, languages. Simpler does not always mean less unambiguous. And the concept of language, even taken in its lexicographical sense, is discussable in itself. There instantly arise questions of correlation between different forms of written language, vernaculars, literary and socially and politically marginalized dialects, pidgins and slangs. In my case, I have simplified the task, arbitrarily enough, with taking the three great tongues of Islam, the Al-Sina'i Salasa of the late medieval scholars of the Middle East, in their classical meaning, and thus deliberately choosing the adjective which is in itself a stumbling stone, which presupposes concrete explication. So under classical Arabic will be understood the South Semitic Koine, which was promoted by the governmental usage of the Caliphate and later by the Islamic system of education and immortalized by a colossal body of poetry and learned prose, following more or less consequently the purest grammar elaborated in the 8th, 9th centuries, Kufa, Basra, and Baghdad. Thanks to this remarkable effort, easily explained by its sacred status, Arabic became the sole literary tongue of Dar al-Islam, which possessed really strictly defined, even canonical rules of spelling, pronunciation, and style. Under classical Persian, or Farsi, disregarding the current understanding of this term denoting the Iranian version of New Persian as opposed to Afghan, Dari, or Tajik in Tajikistan. So we'll be amend the South Iranian dialect, which, absorbing considerable West and East Iranian lexical stuff, gained popularity among intellectuals in the eastern provinces of the decaying Abbasid state. It finally acquired official status under the Seljuks, having already become a great literary language thanks to masterpieces created under preceding dynasties. Differently from the cosmopolitan Lughat al-Dad, classical Arabic, Persian was more rooted geographically, as it always had the greater Iran as its center of radiation, conveying a set of narrative patterns, of which at least a considerable part was inspired by the rhetoric of earthly domination and royal continuity, a circumstance which made its use crucial for bureaucratic purposes, as well as in epic and panegyric poetry in the Muslim East. Under classical Turkic will be comprehended written forms of Kipchak, Kaluk, and Oghuz dialects of Islamized Central Asian and Near Eastern Turks. commonly known, respectively, as Western or Eastern Turki. They had received a strong Persian imprint before acceding to official status, and that mainly from the 15th, 16th centuries. Unlike Farsi, their participation in curricula of Islamic learning was precarious enough and greatly dependent from their brilliant predecessor. The Ottoman case is an exception which confirms the rule, since not only lexically but grammatically the language cultivated by the sublime poet underwent a radical mutation which made it almost unintelligible to average Turkish speakers, an aspect tackled yesterday by Dr. Liesenberg. Having thus introduced my leading characters, or rather situated them into the context of my talk, I should proceed to define the setting. Caucasia is indeed a name all but concrete, despite numerous connotations, myths, and stereotypes surrounding it from Greco-Roman times to recent years. Trying to avoid tiring you of commonplace geographical, ethnographical, and historical facts, I would like to concentrate on that understanding of Caucasia, and there could be a host of others, for sure, which is relevant to my topic. Here and on, I will term Caucasia the lands which lie between the Lesser Caucasus in the south and the Greater Caucasus in the north, adding to them territories stretching along the northern slopes of the latter mountain chain from the Black to the Caspian Sea. That is, roughly to say, the territories between the Armenian Plateau in the south and Pontic Steppes to the north. Thus, there have been no references to the realities reflected on contemporary political maps, which fixed the frontiers in accordance to the results of Russian imperial expansion of early 19th century, the Soviet-era realignment of borders and identities, and post-Soviet independences from 1991 to 2008. This approach underscores the centrality of the Greater Caucasus, and especially its eastern half, in the destinies of Islamicate, to retake Marshall Hodgson's expression, societies of the region. It equally allows us to perceive the logic of Arabic word use, consecrated by al-Masuri's memorable image of al-Qabkh as the mountain of tongues, Jabal al-Alsun, evoking the highlands' phenomenal abundance in linguistic relics and isolates. I think it useful to remind the audience that since some millennia this area has been hosting languages belonging to three families, of which two are endemic, despite conjectures on their much wider spread in remote antiquity, even before the Bronze Age. These are the Kartvelian and the North Caucasian families, the latter falling into two groups, which, according to some classifications, can be themselves regarded as distinct families, West Caucasian and East Caucasian. Their internal diversity is enormous, reaching a truly proverbial scale in Dagestan, where some 30 separate languages are spoken, most of which mutually incomprehensible. Their difference makes specialists in glottochronology suppose that they had separated in several branches around the beginnings of the Iron Age in Western Asia, that is, in the first half of the first millennium before Common Era. This unique variety of vernaculars, first attested for the region by Strabo, was only partly counterweighed by the expansion of Iranic in late antiquity. It added to this linguistic patchwork the Indo-European element, which was further reinforced through the influence of Armenian kingdoms from the south. The 5th and 6th centuries of the Common Era witnessed a major shift in the region's linguistic history, that is, the creation of alphabets for representatives of the two Caucasian families, Georgian, the Kartvelian group, and Albanian, northern, more exactly eastern, or Neko-Dagestanian group. Here and on, I will refer to the ancient land of Caucasian Albania lying roughly on the territory of nowadays independent Azerbaijan and Russian Dagestan as Albania without the additional adjective of Caucasian, all the more that the Balkan Albania did not exist at the time as a geographical entity. Speaking of Azerbaijan, I will mean the vast historical province of Iran, situated to the south of the Araxes River, as there were other names employed before the 18th, 19th centuries for the territory of the contemporary Republic of Azerbaijan. A long competition of national historiographies has greatly influenced the debate over the respective priority in working out this or that writing system. Equally hotly debated is the question of Armenian precedence in this liberation. Without delving in its niceties, too often tinted by patriotic pathos, I will state two general features of these alphabets. First, their Mediterranean roots, which transpire in their reproducing the graphical logic of Greek and Latin, noting vowels with separate graphemes, to the distinction of consonantal Arameo-Iranic writing. Second, their intimate connection to the Oriental churches, respectively the Georgian and the Albanian hierarchies. To resume, on the eve of the Arab-Muslim flood, not demographic, sure, but political, and I dare say ideological, there existed in Caucasia two autochthonous written traditions, without taking the Armenian one, enormously and probably even decisively influent, but still external to the field I have delimited at the beginning. Both ancient Georgian and Albanian possessed already a certain body of ecclesiastical texts, consisting of substantial parts of the biblical canon, lectionaries, and some pieces of hagiography, and probably enjoyed official use, though no significant instances of secular texts, even epigraphic, can be cited for these decades. On the contrary, Middle Persian, the state language of Iran, was evidently employed by the Sassanid administration of Eastern Caucasia. The fact which is corroborated by inscriptions left by high-ranking Iranian functionaries on the wall bricks of the great fortified complex of Darband in today's Dagestan, dating 6th century. From the first centuries of Hegira on, the territories adjacent to the Greater Caucasus turned into the arena of the Caliphate's political expansion. To remind you of some key dates, in 642, troops sent by the Caliph Omar took and devastated the Armenian capital Dvin, Dabil in Arabic, which afterwards became the first headquarters of Muslim armies in the region, as the governorate of Armenia was established to encompass all of Arab-controlled Caucasia. Less dramatic was the incorporation of eastern Georgian lands to the Islamic realm. In 654, Tbilisi, Tiflis, surrendered by a treaty stipulating prerogatives of dhimma status for its inhabitants. By 660, Arabs penetrated Cis-Caucasia, or the North Caucasus, if you wish, by the ancient strategic route along the Caspian coast, transforming the stronghold of Darband, or the Gate of Gates, Bab al-Abwab, as they put it, into the main bulwark of Islam in the north, facing dangerous Khazar steppes during the first four centuries of the Muslim era. To the end of the 7th century, Arab administration, supported by garrisons, was introduced to major cities south of the Greater Caucasus. The consolidation of the Caliphal Empire in the 8th, 9th centuries has left a deep impact on the cultural life of Caucasia, associating the region to the Islamic civilization and its Greco-Semitic synthesis. It additionally consolidated these territories as they were periodically reunited in the framework of same administrative entities. Treaties defining the status of Eastern Caucasian societies in respect to the Caliphate seem to be liberal enough in what concerns religious aspects. The regulations concerning Ahl al-Kitab, the scripturaries, meant in practice that, along with the ecclesiastical hierarchies of local Christians, liturgical languages and their authority were preserved. Zoroastrian communities, less numerous and closer linked to the Iranian imperial presence, evidently suffered more significant pressure. One is also to remember that the Caspian districts of Iran Shahr hosted a multitude of heterodox refugees after the crushing of the Mazdakite rebellion by later Sassanids, and that was to add to their confessional heterogeneity. It was the southeastern parts of Caucasia that were not only first to be Islamized, but also partly Arabized under the last Umayyads and the early Abbasids, a process underscored by the implantation of South Arabian, Kalbi, and North Arabian, Paisi, Bedouin tribes. Islamization progressed much slower to the north of Araxes than to the south of this river, and made its more obvious successes in Mughan and in the basin of the lower Kura, that is, near its junction to the Caspian Sea. where the positions of Christianity had been weak even before the Arabian invasion. The most important centers of the new religion's diffusion were Darband, Ganja, and Bardar, though the latter city also preserved its significance as a metropolitan see of the Armenian Patriarchate. More problematic was the preaching of Islam in mountainous regions, which served as refuges to more or less imposing compact groups of non-Muslim population, Christian Armenians in the Lesser Caucasus and Christian Georgians and Dagestani polytheists in the Greater Caucasus. As for the majority of the districts of Caucasian Albania, their comparatively upland relief and agricultural richness attracted more attention from the part of the new settlers. Changing political conditions accelerated the tempo of cultural and linguistic mutations. Under the Umayyads, Middle Persian was intensively supplanted by Arabic in official use. This tendency achieved much more impressive scale at the beginning of the Abbasid epoch, as one can judge from reports of mass migrations of Bedouin confederations thither. The circumstances surrounding this process were all the more favorable to the implantation of Arabic, that is, that it was at the same time a state language, a sacred tongue, and a dynamical instrument of cultural interaction. In the 9th-10th centuries, it got enriched through spectacular literary development which transformed it in a prestigious vernacular of a brilliant cosmopolitan elite inspired by Greek, Syriac, and Iranian models of high culture. The cities of Iraq, Syria, and Egypt became magnetizing poles for that thin layer of Caucasian Muslim intellectuals who perceived themselves as an organic part of the Dar al-Islam. Arabian migrations into South Caucasia through Azerbaijan were eventually interrupted by a formidable Khurramite revolt of Babak, raging from 816 to 838, and never recommenced since. However, Arab settlements remained noticeable enough in areas adjacent to strategically important localities, Darband, for instance, and hubs of commerce and agricultural trade, Sbarda, as well as in lowland prairies, often controlled by households of Kalbi and Qaisi descent. The bulk of population in the Caucasian possessions of the Caliphate still belong to totally different linguistic elements which can be putatively classified into three massives. Kartvelian, in highland zones to the west, represented by the Georgian dialects. Dagestani, mountainous districts to the north, represented by the Lezgian and Hinalug dialects. And Iranic, predominantly in the plains to the east and south, represented by Persian and Talishi dialects. Armenian exercised a strong influence on that one of the Lezgian languages which had been once predominant in Albania, the old Udi. The presence of Turkic speakers was not decisive, being limited to semi-nomadic groups of late Hunnic origin. Immigrants from Arabia could not boast of numerousness in comparison with these demographically dense groups. But if living Arabic dialects were doomed to rapid disappearance here, the prestige of Arab pedigree and the language of the Prophet were perennial. Reminiscences of Arabian ancestors, genuine or fictitious, were cherished by many an aristocratic family, especially in Dagestan. Only Sassanid genealogy could compete in illustriousness with the idea of descending from an Umayyad governor or an Abbasid grandee. Northern shores of the Kura preserved tens of place names with the component Arab up to the beginning of the 20th century. This complex of trends can, if partly, account for the fact that in the 10th century, the geographers of the Caliphate assessed the dominating positions of Arabic among South Caucasian Muslims. Al-Istakhri named it, with Persian, one of the two languages of Azerbaijan and Arran, ancient Albanian, restraining the use of Armenian to the city of Dvin and its vicinity, as well as the spread of Albanian, which he terms Arraniya, to Bardar. Ibn Hawqal, agreeing with his predecessor in defining the positions of Arabic and Persian as the languages, I cite, as the languages of the people of Azerbaijan and the majority of the denizens of Armenia, paradoxically insisted that, nevertheless, only few people there spoke Arabic, and moreover, it was not understood by Persian speakers. Arabic is fluently mastered by merchants and landlords, he conceded, but for many groups on the margins of Armenia and adjacent countries, there are other languages. A curious remark on the kind of Persian spoken in Armenia and Azerbaijan is made by Al-Muqaddasi, to whose ear local accent reminded of the Khurasani dialect. The same Al-Muqaddasi differed from his precursors, insisting on the fact that in Armenia the spoken language was indeed Armenian, as Iranian, Albanian was in Iran. So one can put forward a hypothesis that cultural and linguistic processes in the 9th, 10th centuries Iran resulted in the gradual Arabization and Persianization of that segment of local elite which opted for Islamization, and that another segment, which remained true to Christianity, adopted Armenian as language of education and of literature. Both shifts were possible only through the stage of long-term bilingualism, which unfortunately escapes our competence due to almost complete lack of sources thereon. Starting from the 9th century, Arabic, gaining the upper hand as a means of literary expression among the expanding Muslim population, began to influence local vernaculars and even ancient written languages of Caucasian Christians. The final breakdown of the consolidated Islamic realm in the 10th century did not impede its progressive spread in the learned urban milieu and the gradual formation of a regional Arabic literary tradition, which was to last till the end of the 19th century and even beyond. But the 11th, 12th centuries saw the emergence of another powerful tool of cultural communication. New Persian penetrated the area through Jibel, or later Iraqi Ajam, a historical region in the northwest of the Iranian plateau, ancient Media, and thanks to the patronage of the Seljukids in the south and the Shirvanshahs in the north, succeeded to in imposing itself as a more than worthy successor to the derelict glories of Middle Persia. The second half of the 11th century is marked for Eastern Caucasia by the ascendance of Oghuz political domination from the south and growing Kipchak presence from the north. These two waves of migration of steppe peoples initiated the centuries-long tide of Turkicization of local populations, which was to reveal its scale on the cultural level only in some 200 or 300 years. Nevertheless, the epochal character of the Seljuk conquests, which installed Turkoman tribes on the shores of the Kura and the Araxes, made itself felt more slightly in Shirvan, that is, between the Kura, the Greater Caucasus, and the Caspian, where the majority seemed to continue speaking Dagestani and Iranic vernaculars. The proof to the surmise that the 10th century geographers' assertions can be accepted as veracious enough, at least if applied to the intellectual elite, lies in the independent evidence given by later witnesses and the evolution which can be observed in the literary material. So, Arabic kept its positions relatively high for some 2.5 centuries from above to the trips of Ibn Hawqal and Al-Muqaddasi. It is from the beginning of the 12th century that we have a Sufi treatise entitled The Estragon of Truths, Raihan al-Haqa'iq, by a sheikh coming from the district of Darband. And we also know that the denizens of the Gate of Gates preserved Arabian dialects in everyday speech, though along with a score of other languages, 12 outright, at least in 1170s, when the city was visited by the Andalusian traveler Al-Gharnati. The earliest pieces of the Persian verse from Caucasia also date from mid-11th century and spring from the Sufi milieu, if one is to give credit to the tradition linking them with the name of the first mystical master of Shirvan, Pir Hussain. More convincing are the data connected with Qatran Tabrizi, born in 1000, dead in 1080. Being a poet laureate of the Kurdish clan of the Rawadids in Azerbaijan, he also praised in his Qasidas the Shaddadid rulers of Ganja. Qatran's case is all the more interesting that he gives a stunning instance of how one could master the poetical language without really commending its spoken and even literary base. Nasiri Khusraw humorously reported his meeting with the Tabrizi bard under 1046 in his Book of Voyages, Safarnoma, Book of Travels. He wrote beautiful verse, but did not know the Persian language properly. He came to me bringing with himself the divans of Munjiq and Daqiqi, evidently viewed as specifically Khurasani masters of high Farsi Dari. The first one flourished in the 9th, the second one in the 10th century. So he read them and asked me to explain difficult passages. I did, and he put down these explanations. Then he read to me his own verses. End of citation. But as for Ganja, we have at the beginning of the next century, that is the 12th century, an intriguing personality whose much disputed legacy, even if it can very probably be the result of collective efforts by two or three generations of libertine and witty townswomen, does nevertheless prove the widespread of written Farsi in a more democratic milieu. The quatrains, Rubaiyat, of Mahasti, often breathe with undisguised sensuality, chanting the virile charms of bazaar youths, and convey to us the lively atmosphere in which Persian seems to have been equally a language of popular literature. Moreover, in late 11th, early 12th centuries, the tongue of Rudaki and Firdowsi acquired utmost importance for the dynastic propaganda by the brilliant court of the Shirvan Shahs from the Banu Yazid family. Paradoxically enough, they were descendants of the Arab governors from the tribe of Shayban, who had been appointed to install Abbasid order in Caucasia under Harun al-Rashid, and had since intermarried into multi-ethnic Shirvani nobility. In mid-11th century, after a short period of chaos, one of the branches of Banu Yazid took power in the princely city of Ash-Shamakhiyya, later Shamakhi, the capital of Shirvan, and to distinguish itself from its Arabophile predecessors, set on cultivating the genealogy remounting to Khosrows I, Anushirvan, the Sassanid, the paragon of just ruler in Islamic symbolism. No wonder that seven or even eight generations of these petty but fastidious potentates preferred to give their heirs the names borrowed from the Book of the Kings, Shahnameh, Afridun, Kavus, Kaykubad, but also coming from more exotic Iranian name stock, Fariburz, Garshasp, Hushang. Ostentatious luxury of the great Khaqan Manuchihr, and know the Turkic title, and the sublime king Akhsitan, his successor, needed to be immortalized. In this context is situated the lavish patronage to Farsi-i Dari, which accounts for the spectacular transformation of this seemingly peripheral area into a hotbed of Persian poetical genius during the 12th century. The initiator was Shirvan Shah Manuchihr, who appointed his chief laureate, Malik al-Shu'ara, an Abul-Ula from Ganja. The latter laid the foundation of a whole literary school, which was perpetuated by the next generation of bards. Falaki and Khaqani elevated Persian verse to an unprecedented degree of intellectual sophistication and stylistic perfection. It is a highly significant fact that both of them received education not only in Islamic humanities, Naqliyat, but also in sciences, Aqliyat, without leaving their native lands. The sage Hakim Nizami Ganjavi's example is universally known. One of the masterpieces of his quintet, Layli-u Majnun, was commanded by and dedicated to Manuchihr's successor, Akhsitan. Even against the background of highbrow Iraqi, in fact, Azerbaijani, if one takes the geographical setting and the, so to say, the homeland of many a representative of this style. So this Iraqi style, Sabki Iraqi, which held Persian poetry under its sway in these centuries. The lyrics and epics of the Shirvani bards strike by their mingling of rationalistic theorization, lofty spiritualism, and technical perfectionism, which demonstrate full acquaintance with all the intricacies of lexical and rhetorical order. The intriguing question, how far the Shirvanis and Iranis were curious about their non-Muslim neighbors, remains in general unanswered, but one may state Haqqani's awareness of Kartvelian linguistical milieu. Georgian words can be found in his divan, though employed mostly for adding exoticism to his erotic and bacchant lyrics. And Nizami's fascination for the memories of the ancient patriarchal see of the Albanian church and the Armenian metropolis in Bardar. In the 13th century, a powerful torrent of Turkoman that is Muslim Oghuz confederations from Central Asia, coming through northern Iran, swept Caucasia, partly fleeing the press of the Mongols, partly accompanying the invaders in their expansion. The strengthening of nomadic features in the economy of the fertile valleys of the Kura and the penetration of Turco-Mongol tribesmen up the highlands made the sedentary population, which lived on a well-developed system of irrigation, to retreat to forested defiles in the greater and lesser Caucasus or to the marshy lowlands of the Caspian. With it, the spread of Iranic and Dagestani vernaculars, as well as some Armenian and Georgian dialects, seems to have shrunk critically. The same centuries witnessed the construction on the basis of the Oghuz dialects spoken by Turkoman tribes of a literary language which can be termed Western Turki, to be distinguished from its Eastern counterpart, having sprung up at an earlier date mostly from Kipchak and Kaluk components. I would like to avoid discussing the degree of continuity between the different stages of Central Asian written Turkic as irrelevant here. For the territories west of Khorasan and east of Asia Minor, the beginnings of literary Turki can be more or less convincingly linked with the personalities of İzzeddin Pûrî Hasan for the lyrical Ghazal and Mustafa Darir and Sulî Fakih for the mystical and romantic Mathnavi, that is, greater epic form of poetry. Azerbaijan, the crown province of the Hulaguid Ilkhanate, was transformed by consecutive migrations into one of the cradles of that variant of spoken and probably written Turkic, which was seen as somewhat standard by the authors of the first Arab Turkic and Arab Persian dictionaries, Ibn Muhanna and Hindu Shah Nakhchivani. Despite the unprecedented growth of importance of Turkic, underscored by the employ of Uyghur scribes in the Ilkhanid bureaucracy, the domination of Arabic and Persian in administration, but especially in scientific, scholarly, and political production, was unshaken. As is well known, the Mongol emperors discouraged panegyrics, not because of their freedom from vanity, but being culturally alien to this type of stately propaganda. This detail accounts for the decline of court encomia during the Hulaguid century. Though some rare pieces of this genre have been preserved in anthologies and in epigraphy, notably the Turkic Madh by Nasir Bakui in the honor of Olcitu Sultan, with dubious authenticity though. This general tendency is reflected in an almost total extinction of the great Shirvani school of panegyrism, with its last representative Zulfiqar, born in 1190, dead in around 1245. The Mongol era, and especially the 14th, 15th centuries, witnessed the flowering of Caucasian Persian literature, but at the same time, the birth of Islamic Turkic literary language, Kipchak-based North Caucasian Turki in Cis-Caucasia, and Oghuz-based Azerbaijani Turki in Trans-Caucasia, the latter being much more Arabicized and Persianized than the former. Rampant Turkicization was further intensified by the political turmoil of the second half of the 14th century, in which the catastrophic expeditions of Timur Lang and the transplantation of Turkoman tribes to the north of the Araxes by his son Miran Shah marked only an episode. At this time, highly Persianized Oghuz speech acquired characteristics of a full-fledged literary language. A great part in this transformation was played by its growing use in preaching by Hurufis, that extremist Shia movement which generated an imposing body of poetic texts circulating in a vast space from eastern Anatolia to the Caspian since the beginning of the 15th century. Its most brilliant representative was Imad ad-Din Nasimi, whose passionate ghazals led their way not only to the Shi'i Turkic, but equally to the Armenian milieu. Cited literature in southeastern Caucasia remained, however, in the general trend of the Persian poetry of the age of Hafiz. This art is illustrated by two names of certain glow, the court preceptor and calligrapher of the Shirvan Shahs, Arif Ardebili, who authored Farhad Nameh in 1369-1370, a response, poetical response, that is, the poem written in the same meter with the same composition, Nazide, or Javab, on Nizami's Khusrau Shirin, and Badr Shirvani, a lyrical and panegyric poet of some merit who flourished in the first half of the 15th century. Intellectual production of Shirvani scholars did not rank lower. Mir Sayyid Yahya al-Bakuyi, or Yahya al-Bakuyi, if you wish, dead in 1464, who wrote in both great languages of Islam, left a considerable hermeneutic legacy, commenting, among others, Shabistari's versified manual of Sufism, Gulshan-i-Raz, as well as composing astronomical treatises. His disciples, Diyad-din Yusuf, dead in 1485, and Kamal ad-Din, dead in 1499, together with several other savants of the circle of Mir Sayyid Yahya, concentrated themselves on mystical aspects of spiritual knowledge, preserving bilingual proficiency. Despite intensive linguistic Turkicization, evident among the majority of the region's Muslim population, and the Turkic dialect's strong impact on North and South Caucasian languages, written versions of Oghuz and Kipchak failed to shake the hegemony of Arabic and Persian as vehicles of governance and education in Caucasia up to the Russian conquest. In the west of the region, the rise of Ottoman in the 16th and 17th centuries did not affect the linguistic situation, which was initially different from that observed in eastern Caucasia, with its variety of minor but stable scholar centers and its network of madrasas responsible for upholding the high level of Islamic learning. The Safavid epoch stabilized the results of the general trends of preceding two or three centuries towards linguistic Turkicization from below, so to say, coexisting with the relative conservatism demonstrated by the Arabo-Persian Hochkultur, which was reluctant to welcome a third member to the duo of the prestigious Al-Lisanain, despite the fact that Turks, or rather Turkophones, had become not only a considerable part of the population, but moreover formed the great majority of the Transcaucasian and Ciscaucasian ruling elite. As further naturalization of the Oghuz dialects in southern Caucasia accelerated its pace to the detriment of ancient zones of Georgian, Armenian, and Persian predomination, and in North Caucasus, Kipchak dialects were winning the competition with Dagestani vernaculars, Turkic began to play the part of the region's universal lingua franca, understood, spoken, and practiced by broader masses of rural, but equally of urban population. Most revealing is the example of Shamakhi, the population of which, despite its extremely variegated ethnical composition, passed almost entirely to Azerbaijani Turkic. This has been admirably observed by Adam Olearius, who wrote in 1630s, "The city is inhabited by Persians, Armenians, and partly by Georgians, though each of these nations has its own language. All of them, as the denizens of Shirvan in general, speak Turkish." Paradigmatic is the figure of Fuzuli, born in 1498, dead in 1556, from Baghdad, a versatile polymath from Baghdad, who wrote in all three of the Al-Sinai Salasi. Having never left Iraq, if not for one notoriously disenchanting travel to Istanbul, he nevertheless succeeded in leaving a wealth of mystical and didactic poetry, hagiography and doxography, which was read and admired from Anatolia to Fergana in Central Asia during the last four centuries by Sunnis and Shiites alike, though he himself was a pious dweller. We need not enter into the scanty information of his biography, all the more that his life as such did not concern Caucasia, if one ignores unsubstantiated guesses on his descent from the Karabakh branch of the Oghuz tribe of Bayat. Fuzuli is, however, greatly significant for South Caucasian Muslims as an undisputed literary classic, whom they styled Ustad al-Makatib, the master of al-Makatib, the master of primary schools, even in the 19th century, due to the enormous popularity of his texts in the traditional system of education. It is not for nothing that not only responses, nazire, were written on his ghazals and strophic poems, but it did also inspire the first opera in the Islamic world, the Azerbaijani composer Uzeyir Hacıbekov's Leyli-i Majnun directly bases its libretto on Fuzuli's masterpiece. But one has to remember that if Fuzuli was born under the Sultanate of White Sheep Turkomans, and after its fall greeted the establishment of Safavid dominion over Mesopotamia, He spent the greater part of his life under Ottoman authority, which was actively enhancing literary creation in Turkish. But in the Safavid state, the Oghuz language of the ruling circles did not achieve even that degree of standardization and officialization, which was typical already for the 16th century Ottoman. It remained an instrument of restricted courtly and military use, never pretending to supplant Persian in the domains of administration, intellectual, or sophisticated artistic creation. Even if we take in consideration that Ottoman influence did penetrate into the region through several more or less successful attempts of conquest, its impact was not so lasting as to reverse the general setting. Nevertheless, the 16th, 17th centuries witnessed a significant rise of interest among Iranian intellectuals toward the tongue of the Turkomans. The era of Turkic-Persian dictionaries was succeeded by the era of Persian grammars of Turkic, evidently essential for introducing the parlance of the court and the army to Persian-speaking officialdom. The madrasas of Shamakhi, Baku, and Durband were the only educational options accessible to that part of the population that was eager acquiring social status through intellectual achievement. They oriented students towards the scholastic knowledge in Shiite theology, hadith, and Sharia law, but also Imamite gnosis, Irfan. The practical aspect, beside the possibility to make a career of a jurist or to enter the ranks of relatively well-remunerated ulama, was indeed profound knowledge of Farsi, which was the unique language of official use and diplomacy. All that played a conservative role, influencing the linguistic attitudes of South Caucasian Muslims, in spite of an almost universal use of Turkic as language of everyday communication and folklore. The audience. So to resume this lengthy generalization, let us drop an eye on the positions of the Arsinei Salasse in the Caucasian lands on the eve of the Russian conquest. Despite the fact that Persian remained the only language of bureaucracy in the petty khanates which emerged from the debris of Nadir Shah's administrative machine after 1747, its literary functions were sensibly diminished by the rise of Azerbaijani Turki, that Oghuz vernacular which managed to preserve its lively and, one would even say, democratic character despite heavy Persianization. Turkic poetry of South Caucasia presents an interesting example of an interethnic lingua franca as its leading means of expression. The strophic songs of the Ashiks, minstrels, troubadours, transcended communitarian boundaries with their almost supra-religious message of the eroticized cult of beloved Yar. This Ashik Turkic was responsible for the creation of a common symbolical universe in which an Armenian townsman and a Lezgi highlander found equal delight. Combining the simplicity of syllabic meters with strict and yet flexible composition, popularizing Arabic and Persian metaphysical vocabulary, echoing political catastrophes and narrating current military events, it was assimilating its predecessors' terminological potential and integrating it into a new linguistic organism. All these developments prepared the way to Azerbaijani poetry and drama in the 19th century, responsive to tectonic shifts in social-cultural life of the new Russian Caucasia. Very distinct, indeed, is the case of Arabic. Differently from Turki and Farsi, it was mostly cultivated out of the sphere of Safavid and Ottoman domination. It is beginning from the turn of the 18th century that we are able to detect the intensification of Arabic studies in Dagestan, though they surely had their background in the preceding centuries, as we have reports of Dagestani students and even professors visiting in their quest for knowledge, talabul ilm, Ottoman Syria and even Yemen. The internal dynamics underlying this blooming of Arabiyat are still to be cleared up. This was the age of traditionalist scholarship, pedestrian, but relatively abundant, both Sharia-minded and moderate Sufi, which expressed itself in bookish fusha, polished and puristic. Probably emulating their foremost authority, the Imam Ash-Shafi'i, Dagestani ulama quite often indulged in versification,
producing impeccable gnomic kasidas and kitas, imitating the style and diction of panegyrists like al-Buhturi and ascetics like Abul Atahiyya. This intellectual conservatism, or should we say classicism, broke the ground for the Islamic revival which was to ripen in the next century through a hard commotion of the Imamate movement and the fabulously exhausting struggle against the Russian imperial pressure. In comparison with the two impetuous elements, the Turkic and the Arabic, gaining or regaining their élan vital to the close of the 18th century, Persian was finally losing its glow. No longer buttressed by any influential court in immediate vicinity, it eventually suffered from the establishment of Russian rule. That is not to say that Russian officials made any conscient effort to impede its study or to ruin its prestige. On the contrary, during all the first half of the 19th century, one can cite several regional chronicles and poems in excellent Farsi dedicated to imperial administrators and even monarchs, to say nothing of brilliant coteries of Transcaucasian nobles and literati even in later decades. But having fallen out of the atmosphere of Persianate Hochkultur, Farsi became, as it seems, especially vulnerable, since it remained without tangible societal and spiritual backing. It could compete neither with Arabic, a sacred tongue of revelation, nor with Turkic, as lively vernacular receptive to new literary models. At the same time, its consecrated quality of intellectualized vehicle of education and worldly etiquette withered more and more faced with Russian. The language of Pushkin and Lermontov, which was more or less the same as that of general governors and emperors, for sure, imposed itself over the tongue of Sa'di and Hafez through several decades of that non-violent tournament, peaceful and all the more decisive culturally and socially than the several years of armed strife between the armies of Romanovs and Qajars. Taking a certain degree of audacity, one may style it the last great intralingual clash which closed the pre-modern history of Muslim Caucasia. Thank you for your complacency and patience.